Our reading this evening is from the New Testament, from the book of Hebrews. The main reading is Hebrews chapter 11, but I'm just going to start reading with the last couple of verses of Hebrews 10 and just read through into the first three verses of Hebrews 12. So beginning at Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. But we are not of them who draw back unto perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony, that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world, and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians, essaying to do, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down, after they were compassed about 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. I'm fairly confident everyone here is familiar with the poem For the Fallen by Lawrence Binyon. It begins with proud thanksgiving, a mother for her children. England mourns for her dead across the sea. Flesh of her flesh they were, spirit of her spirit, fallen in the cause of the free. And if you don't know the first verse, you'll definitely know the fourth verse. They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them. When I was researching this poem, I imagined it was written, like a lot of the war poems, by someone who'd seen the chaos of the fields and the trenches and so on. But actually, it was written less than 2 months after the start of the First World War, not as a response to the battlefields, but rather it was based on the author's experience of seeing young men march away to the Western Front. And that fourth verse, and sometimes the third verse, are regularly read out on Remembrance Day in the countries of the former Allies. And often when that last line is read out, we will remember them is repeated as a response. And when people are saying that, they're pledging to remember those who have sacrificed their own lives for a cause. It's not necessarily expressing support for each war in which souls have been lost. Certainly not a boast that every aspect of each war has been just. But it is a recognition of the great sacrifice made by so many men and women. We will remember them. And yet you and I, we don't actually remember those who marched off to Passchendaele, to Mons, to Ypres, to the Somme. And there are fewer and fewer around who will remember someone who perished in the battle against Nazism. I read this morning there were expected to be only 6 men marching at the cenotaph from the Normandy Veterans Association. Not many who can remember those fallen in the Second World War and say, we will remember them. Perhaps you might remember someone who perished in the Falklands crisis or the more recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But for most of us, The only link we have to those who have sacrificed so much is by finding out about them after the event. At my old school, every remembrance service, they would read out the names of the old boys who'd fallen in the wars. Their names were remembered, but no one remembered them as individuals. No teachers were still at the school, and most of their fellow schoolmates have probably now passed away. But so we need to find out, we need to read for ourselves, we need to talk to others, we need to learn more about the history and sacrifice of these events, of these individuals, before we can then say we will remember them. Now, there's a certain value in doing that. It teaches us to better value life. It teaches us to appreciate sacrifice, to rejoice in the freedoms that have been bought for us at such cost, to see something of the errors and the foolishness that claims so many lives, to desire that never again will these tragic events be necessary. A right view of what has gone before should help us appreciate better our own situation. And it's interesting as well, just to consider why these men and women made this sacrifice. What was it that motivated them? People who left home and comfort, security and family, to face the grim battlefields of Belgium, Berlin, Basra. Perhaps these were people motivated by patriotic love for king and country. Perhaps it was a hatred of evil. Perhaps it was a more parochial longing and concern to defend their own families. Perhaps it was because they needed employment and here was a job offered to them. Perhaps it was just to stand shoulder to shoulder with their friends. If you know the history of the First World War, you'll know that in the first couple of years, PALS battalions were formed. Men who knew each other, all the men of a town or from a workplace, signed up together. They were put in the same battalion so they would fight shoulder to shoulder. Motivated perhaps to battle just by standing with their friends. Well, when the author of the Hebrews was writing to Jewish Christians in the first century, he is pointing back to those who have gone before, those who have made all kinds of great sacrifices. And he's writing with a particular purpose. He is seeking to reassure struggling Jewish converts. He is trying to remind them of the benefits of following Christ, even though that pathway of pilgrimage leads through periods of suffering, sorrow, and sacrifice. He wants us to see these people mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as witnesses, not witnesses of us, but witnesses to us, bearing testimony to us about the Christian life, its reality, its joys, its troubles. He wants us to remember them, to consider their lives, their sacrifice. He wants us to learn lessons from them about endurance and their motivation. So there's three questions I want us to have in our minds as we look at this chapter. What did they endure? How did they endure? How can we endure? So the first question, what did they endure? Well, the very first name mentioned is Abel, almost from the dawn of the world, mentioned in the fourth chapter of Genesis, Adam and Eve's second reported child. Abel pleased God. Did it bring him success and prosperity? No, it stirred up his brother's resentment and jealousy. And because of his faithfulness, he was put to death by his own brother. What about Noah? Noah looked like a fool for decades, building an enormous ark for a disaster no one around him believed would ever happen. He was a preacher of righteousness, but how many people believed his preaching? No one, it would seem. He didn't rescue anyone at all. Only his own household was saved. Abraham was a comfortable pagan in one of the greatest cities of the world. But he left his home, his family. He went to a country that was not his. He lived amongst a foreign people. When his wife died, he didn't even possess land to bury her. He was told that he would be the father of many nations, but he and Sarah died not having received the promises. They were strangers and pilgrims on earth, sojourners, those who are just passing through, never really comfortable, never able really to say they're completely at home in the here and now. Abraham's commitment was absolute, even to the extent where he was called upon to sacrifice his own beloved son, Isaac. Isaac doesn't go on to see the promises given to Abraham fulfilled. He dies a stranger in the foreign land of Canaan. Jacob and Joseph die in Egypt. They're not even in the land that's been promised. They die hundreds of miles away from that place. Moses' parents have a choice to obey the law of the land or to risk their own lives to protect their newborn son. Moses himself grows up in prosperity and comfort as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. Yet he chooses the way of suffering, the way of sacrifice, identifying with the enslaved Jews rather than enjoying his adoptive status. He opts rather to suffer affliction. He forsakes Egypt. He chooses to identify with a despised race. And you can read through of the others in Hebrews 11. Many who under God are used to achieve great things, but all who know having to pay the price of losing comfort and popularity. Think of Rahab and everything she lost. Think of David, who was this faithful man in many ways, but at times he could have made his own path easier. He could have put Saul to death repeatedly when he had opportunity, but he said, "No, I will not strike down the Lord's anointed," even though Saul was to seek to take David's life at future opportunities. Many others mentioned here know little of material blessing. They are tortured. They don't accept deliverance. We read about trials of cruel mockings, scourgings, imprisonment, being stoned, being sawn in half, being tested, being killed with the sword. And we see the cost that it was in the Old Testament to be a follower of Christ. But it's not just limited to the Old Testament. You read into the New Testament, and Stephen boldly preaches before the Pharisees and is put to death, stoned, even whilst he is seeing Christ in heaven. And you can think of the terrible things that went on, not only in the New Testament, but in the first few centuries afterwards. How when the Romans sought to really oppress the Christians, hundreds, thousands of them were put to death at times. The place I'm from, St. Albans, is named after one of the first martyrs in this country. A Christian priest came to Alban, and he spoke with Alban, and Alban became convinced of the truth of these things and became a Christian himself. And then the Roman soldiers came and knocked on the door of Alban, this Roman citizen, and he would not tell them where the priest was. So they took Alban and they put him to death. And it's not just something from hundreds of years ago. It is still an ongoing reality. Just 17 years ago, in North Korea's South Pyongan province, a unit of the North Korean army was tasked with widening a highway connecting Pyongyang to a nearby port city. While they were demolishing a vacant house, soldiers found in the basement, hidden between two bricks, a Bible and a list of 25 names. And among those lists were individuals identified as a Christian pastor, two assistant pastors, two elders, and 20 parishioners who could be identified by their occupations. And they found these 25 people. They were hunted down at their workplaces by the military police. They were rounded up and detained without any formal judicial procedure. And then later that month, the parishioners and the clergy were brought to that road construction site. Spectators had been arranged in neat rows to observe the public execution of the pastor and elders. And according to a report based on an eyewitness account, the five church leaders were bound hand and foot and made to lie down in front of a steamroller, accused of subversion, of being Kidokyo, Protestant Christian spies. The 20 parishioners were detained near the clergy and watched along with the assembled audience as the five Christian leaders were told they could escape death if they would but deny their faith and pledge to serve only Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung. According to the eyewitness, the clergy remained silent. For their steadfast belief, those Christian men were executed. And in our own land, we have known such liberties and freedom in the past couple of centuries. Yet you'll still find Christians who know something of mockery, shame in their workplace. Perhaps those who've lost their job because they've taken a stand on morality or honesty. Midwives who refuse to partake in supporting abortions or organising abortions and having to pay an economic or price for it. Those who express their Christian views, even in a private sphere, having to answer for it in the workplace, knowing reduction in pay or even losing their jobs. And it's just the long line continuing from Hebrews chapter 11. Men and women who have been prepared to give up everything. These people in Hebrews 11, they were destitute, they were afflicted, they were tormented, they were wandering in mountains, dens, and caves. And none of the ones in this chapter even received the promise. They hadn't yet tasted really what they were waiting for. And so the writer to the Hebrews is trying to encourage them, endure, stand fast. But can those first century Christians really endure all things? Can 21st century Christians really endure all things? What would be a strong enough motivation for you and for me to undergo these sacrifices, these privations? Motivation, then. That's our second point. How did they endure? How did they keep going? None of us seek out suffering. We naturally want comfort. We naturally want peace. We naturally want to avoid strife and trouble. And so given that we love these things, given that these people were people like you and me, they would have loved comfort. How could they forsake safety and the hope of a pleasurable life? What could be of more value to them than their own existence? Remember, many of them saw no benefit in their lifetime from the things they underwent. Verse 13 says, they died in faith, not having received the promises. They confessed, rather, that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. But although they hadn't received the promises, they saw them afar off. They were persuaded of them. They did embrace them. But they were motivated by something more. Verse 16 says, they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. They were looking ahead. They were enduring these things because they had something greater still in view. You can think of examples of that, where you put off the comfort now for something better in the future, saying no to that extra cake so that you can fit into that item of clothing. Locking up your money now as an investment because it will bring you a better return in a year. Taking a firm line with your children now, although it's a headache at the moment, because ultimately it will be better for you and for them in the long run. Making the sacrifice now for the advantage of what lies ahead. Britain could have sued for peace in 1940, but the hope of victory over Nazi Germany outweighed the fear of defeat. The Hebrews 11 Christians sacrifice so much because they have a far greater goal in mind. They are living their lives for something that God has promised. It might now cost them comfort, companionship, prosperity, acceptance, even to the extent of martyrdom, but it is worth it for what lies ahead, a heavenly country prepared for them by God himself. It is better for them to be rejected by the world with everything that means: shame, scorn, mockery, imprisonment, redundancy, homelessness, poverty, death. Better to face all of those things than be rejected by God. Better for Moses to lose all status with his adopted family and identify with the despised family through whom the Messiah will one day come. Abel's commitment to God cost him his life. Noah's commitment cost him 100 years of labor. Rahab's commitment costs her entire culture. But they did it. How did they know the sacrifice was worth it? The sacrifice giving up ease and comfort now for something else later. What for them was the evidence of these unseen blessings? The assurance that these good things would arrive, that it wasn't all a sacrifice in vain. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's how they endured: faith, trust, reliance. But faith isn't complete in and of itself. Faith in what? Reliance on what? Not just a general airy-fairy belief in karma, that there's this unseen force behind the universe, that if I do good here, perhaps it will return to me in future months or years. No, it is a trust in God. And not an airy-fairy confidence, not just positive thinking, well, you know, God will look out for me. But it is a trust that in a specific God who has revealed himself, who has revealed his word, who has spoken, who has said things, that he will keep his promises. Not perhaps always even a feeling that God will do this, but with or without strong feeling or emotion, believing that God will do what he says. True faith will have God as its object. It will rely on him. If God has said something, true faith says, I believe it will come to pass. True faith is taking God at his word. It's not insisting that God conforms to our ideas and our expectations. True faith is a conviction that God knows what he's doing, even when you and I do not. I don't think it can be better expressed than the way Job said it. Job chapter 13. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. But I will maintain mine own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation. How did these Christians endure? They trusted God and his word. God had said he would bring about a Messiah, so they trusted. God had promised to bring about a means through whom, whereby every nation on earth would be blessed, so they trusted. Think of the Israelites standing at the opening of the Red Sea, and here is this bizarre thing. There is a dry path through the sea, but there is water piled up each side. Common sense is shouting at them, go in there, that water is not expected to stay there, it's going to fall on you and drown you. But the promise of God is to care for them. And so they march through as on dry land. What did they endure? How did they endure? How can you and I endure? What means do we have to sustain us in a difficult and opposing world? How could the Hebrew believers who were being written to endure when persecution was rising? Numerous difficulties were facing them because of their profession of faith, and they were being tempted to turn away from this Jesus. It's all the same thing. It's the same as the Old Testament Christians, by trusting God, by believing his revealed word. In Malachi chapter 3, God tells us, for I am the Lord, I change not. The God in whom the Old Testament saints trusted is the same God that the New Testament saints were looking to. It's the same God we are worshipping here today. The one by whom the worlds were made. The one who is a just and righteous God. The one who cannot forget sin and iniquity. The one who must punish it. The God who promises blessing and restoration to Adam and Eve, even as they are being cast out of the Garden of Eden. The one who is promising that through Abraham every nation on earth will be blessed. He is the same God who makes promise of blessing and restoration throughout the Old Testament. He is the same God who promises to send one who will be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. So as the Old Testament saints looked by faith to what lay ahead, they trusted God. They trusted God's word of grace. They valued the reproach of the people of Christ as greater than any earthly prosperity. You and I can look to the same thing. Not trusting in ourselves, our works, our heritage, but trusting only in God, in the God of grace and of mercy, the one who promises to redeem, even at infinite cost to himself. We have the same expectation and hope as these Old Testament believers in many ways. Is it different at all? Well, there is a difference. They, in their lifetimes, did not see the promise fulfilled. But you and I, we see these promises fulfilled in great extent. They only saw the shadow of the Messiah looking ahead. They could not see clearly what would happen in time to come. But we see clearly who the Messiah is and how he has brought about salvation. Eternity is broken into time. God has been made manifest in flesh. The Creator has walked amongst us with human flesh upon his frame. Sin has been dealt with by the death and resurrection of Christ. He has purchased the redemption, the restoration, the hope and salvation that before was only pledged. And that's why the writer goes through the whole of chapter 11 of Hebrews, telling us, remember them, remember them, remember them. But then he gets to chapter 12, and he, as it were, goes on to another level again. He says, consider him. Consider this Christ, who we can read about in detail. The one who has provided a full and final payment for sin. The one who has demonstrated his power to forgive all who come to him by his resurrection victory. The one who has ascended into heaven. The one who has promised, the promise of God, to return from heaven to take us to the Father's side. He more than anyone else, is the one we are to consider. And so when we perhaps are considering quitting, we must look to this one who has done everything necessary to redeem us. He did not turn back when he viewed the difficulties ahead. He looked ahead to Jerusalem, knowing full well what lay ahead, and he set his face like flint, preparing to go through it, the shame, the agony and suffering, for the joy of what lay beyond that. When following him perhaps brings us into times of poverty, look to him, this one who has left the splendor of heaven for the barrenness of a manger, who in adult life had nowhere to lay his head. When you are undergoing times of suffering, forsakenness, look to this one who has suffered in our place, the one who has been forsaken so that we need never be. When you are facing even death itself, the death of persecution or the death of illness or of old age, whatever it may be, look to this one who provides life forevermore, the one who redeems your life from destruction, the one who crowns you with loving kindness and tender mercies, the one who bids you come to him to lose your life in him that you might save it. And so if you are his today, look to him. Be encouraged and strengthened in the battle, because he came for weak and ruined sinners, not for successful and proud self-righteous ones. The blood-bought victories of men do not bring about everlasting peace. It is the shed blood of the glorious God-man Jesus Christ that brings about eternal peace, that brings about a certain expectation of newness of life. And if you are not his today, I've got nothing different to say to you. I urge you also, consider him. Look to Jesus. He is the only ultimate hope this world can have. He is the only true hope for you today. The Lord Jesus Christ, not a mere teacher or healer from Galilee, but the one who framed the worlds, the one who was born in poverty, the one who taught in the face of rejection, the one who died under the wrath of the Father, the one who rose in glory to redeem all of his people. Will you look to him today? That's the prayer expressed with our final hymn. Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Naught be all else to me save that thou art, thou my best thought, by day or by night, waking or sleeping, thy presence my light. We'll close by singing that hymn.